Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, Hurricane Isabel reaches land packing less punch than first feared.
A Wall Street titan falls. Will more follow?
Are we going to see more scandals? I think so, unfortunately. As Mr. Grasso didn't get it, quote unquote, other CEOs still don't get it.
And some of Beirut's hottest night spots resurrect images of war. We talked to the architect who's building among the ruins.
Life has to go on, and it is normal that you go back to these sites and you inject life into them. I think it would be less respectful to put buildings that negate the recent history.
These stories and music from fiddle player Natalie McMaster, coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. Hurricane Isabel has already left more than 130,000 homes and businesses without electricity in coastal North Carolina and Virginia. NPR's Adam Hochberg is in Manteo, North Carolina, on the Outer Banks, where winds have been clocked at up to 85 miles per hour.
This is normally a pretty crowded beach resort area in the Nags Head community, Kitty Hawk, Hill Devil Hills, but it is a ghost town here, except for emergency workers and the news media and some hardy residents who've decided to stay back. The fast food restaurants, the hotels, almost every business you see is boarded up. Houses either are boarded up or they have asterisks of tape on the windows, the way that people tape windows before a hurricane to try to keep the glass from shattering. People just hunkered down, waiting for the storm to pass through.
NPR's Adam Hochberg in Manteo, North Carolina. The center of the hurricane has been carrying sustained maximum winds of up to 100 miles per hour. Forecasters say Isabel should cross Cape Hatteras early this afternoon and will move into Virginia, West Virginia, Maryland, New Jersey, Delaware, and Pennsylvania by tomorrow. Rusty Jacobs of member station WUNC is in Washington, North Carolina, west of the Outer Banks.
Flooding is the major concern here. 1999 Hurricane Floyd left many parts of the area under anywhere from 6 to 10 feet of what they call storm surge, and they're expecting high winds with Hurricane Isabel, and it's the winds that push water off the sound into the river, and that's what it puts people's houses underwater.
Rusty Jacobs of member station WUNC. Much of the nation's capital is shut down in preparation for Hurricane Isabel. Federal government offices are closed, and the Washington, D.C. Metro Transit system has shut down. Eyewitnesses say four U.S. soldiers have been killed in an ambush in Iraq. Their army convoy was attacked on a main highway west of Baghdad. However, a U.S. military spokesman will only say there have been injuries. NPR's Guy Raz in the Iraqi capital says such convoys are a familiar sight in Iraq.
Military convoys travel roads in and out of Baghdad to towns like Haldia, Fallujah in the north, to Samarra and to Crete all the time. You see them on the roads in the capital here in Baghdad. You see them all over the country. Many of these convoys travel normally in five-vehicle convoys, but often they're just two, three-vehicle convoys. So they're very, very vulnerable to attack, particularly in more remote areas like where this attack took place near Haldia.
NPR's Guy Raz in Baghdad. At this hour on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 70 points at 96.16, an active trading of more than 620 million shares. The NASDAQ Composite is up 15.6 points at 18.98. The S&P 500 is up 9.76. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, the United Auto Workers Union has reached a tentative contract deal with General Motors. Jerome Vaughn with Detroit Public Radio reports.
General Motors is the last of the big three automakers to reach an agreement with the UAW. The four-year deal covers 115,000 active employees at General Motors, as well as about 30,000 workers at parts supplier Delphi. Union officials say no details of the contract will be released prior to ratification. UAW President Ron Gettelfinger says the agreements reached this week show a spirit of cooperation between the union, automakers, and suppliers.
In the last 5 days, we have successfully concluded negotiations with five of the largest manufacturers in the world.
The UAW reached tentative contracts with Ford and Visteon on Monday night. A deal was worked out with Daimler Chrysler on Sunday. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Vaughn in Detroit.
The New York Stock Exchange Board of Directors must now start a search for a successor to Richard Grasso, who resigned as chairman yesterday amid controversy over his pay package. Grasso will keep the $139.5 million in benefits and savings from his 3 decades with the NYSE. The board agreed that co-chief operating officers Robert G. Britz and Catherine R. Kinney will oversee the exchange's daily operations until a new chairman is found. Kinney hosted the opening bell today. The world's largest cruise company, Carnival Corporation, said today its third-quarter earnings rose by nearly half. Carnival credited its merger with P&O Princess Cruises. The company also said that passenger bookings have come back following the war in Iraq. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, Hurricane Isabel has made landfall, with the eye of the storm now on the Outer Banks of North Carolina. Top winds of 100 miles per hour have lashed the coastal barrier islands. Isabel was once a Category 5 monster storm, but it's now diminished so much it's only a borderline Category 2 storm. Some North Carolinians are even referring to it dismissively as Izzy. Still, in Washington, D.C., the federal government, schools, and public transportation all shut down today, and the police chief in Virginia Beach, Virginia, advised people who didn't evacuate to write their names on their arms in permanent marker for identification purposes, he said, just in case. Joining us on the line now from New Bern, North Carolina, is Megan George. She's a reporter for Public Radio East. And Megan, I understand you spent the night at the station. How bad is it down there?
Well, the wind is really starting to pick up at the moment, and unfortunately, I'm stuck in an interior office right now, so I can't look outside, but the wind is starting to pick up. I heard my coworkers scrambling around, and then I heard them mention something about duct tape while I was on hold, so hopefully nothing has happened.
Yeah, we're starting to treat the storm a little dismissively, but 100-mile-an-hour winds are still awfully hard to stand up in, can still be awfully dangerous.
Oh, I think it definitely can still be dangerous. Wind gusts have been reported near Cape Hatteras at about 82 miles per hour, also at Cedar Island, 70 miles per hour, and they're still expecting strong winds to spread inland towards us. So I definitely think there are some dangerous times ahead in the next 24 hours.
And 300,000 people in North Carolina and Virginia have evacuated their homes. Lots of people in shelters, huh?
Yes. We have about 8,200 people in shelters. There are about 122 shelters right now in North Carolina.
What is the greatest concern down there? We hear, of course, about the storm surge. Now, in Hurricane Floyd back in 1999, the storm passed and people thought it was kind of over, and then the flooding started, right?
That's right. There was serious flooding in North Carolina after Floyd, and people are concerned about storm surge this time around. Most of the rivers are at about normal. Some of them are beginning to get above normal in terms of flood stage, so storm surge flooding is still an issue, and it's been raining pretty heavily. The National Weather Service is predicting about 10 inches of rainfall possibly in eastern North Carolina, so anything could happen. We've also heard reports of rainfall locally here in or flooding that is locally here in New Bern.
Megan, power outages?
Oh, yes. Quite a few power outages. About 20,000 households in North Carolina are without power.
Do you think that because of what happened after Floyd, the terrible flooding, then people are better prepared, more wary this time?
Definitely. People are better prepared. People also have a been-there-done-that attitude. I think they're just waiting to see what happens, taking it as it comes, and then they'll deal with it after the fact.
So if you go near a window in your radio station there, what will you hear? Are the winds howling?
The winds are howling. The large, tall Carolina pines are blowing in the wind. It looks pretty scary if you look outside right now. There are some trees downed in surrounding counties right now where we're at in Craven County. We haven't heard of any downed trees, but when you look outside, it definitely seems like it's a possibility.
Megan George, stay safe, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Megan George is a reporter for Public Radio East in New Bern, North Carolina.
Well, a hurricane strikes with all the sudden fury of an avenging army, but the costs of a hurricane are much more subtle. Weather forecasting, hurricane research, disaster planning, disaster relief, the costs of construction, building codes. We spend money on hurricanes in foul weather and fair, but is it worth it? Hugh Willoughby is the former director of the Hurricane Program at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Now he's at the Hurricane Research Center at Florida International University, where he's looking at the economics of hurricanes. And Hugh Willoughby, welcome.
Good to be here.
Well, first of all, tell us, how much do we spend on hurricane research and forecasting? And in your opinion, is that worth it?
We spend, based on kind of an unscientific survey among the people who spend the money, we spend just under $100 million a year on the office work that goes into hurricanes. This doesn't include civil engineering projects and enforcement of building codes, but on planning, preparation, all the things that you're seeing as Isabel comes on shore.
Yeah, and I read in the Baltimore Sun that the people who live in the areas of hurricanes can spend up to $1 million a mile just preparing for it.
That figure has sort of a dubious history, but certainly it's not $10 million a mile, and it's not $100,000 a mile. And we know it costs a lot of money to evacuate people, board up businesses, do all of these things, and when you raise warnings, we think that the total cost of warnings is somewhere between $100 million and maybe as much as $500 million, depending on the coastline that's warned and how much is warned.
Well, and how much effect does it have?
If you look at all the things that are going on to get ready for Isabel, you can't show that you're really saving any money.
But are you saving lives?
That we have a pretty good handle on. In the 1950s, which are a pretty good baseline year because hurricane forecasting was more or less the same science it is now, we lost about 60 people a year, 65, 67, something like that. Since then, the coastal populations have increased by a factor of more than three. So if we were doing things the way we did them in 1950, we'd be losing 220 or 230 people a year. And in fact, we lose 20 or 30 people a year. So we're saving a couple hundred lives.
Well, then that's a good thing. I mean, people would say any amount of money, that would be worth it.
Well, folks who do these calculations assign a financial value to an untimely death of something like $5 million for an untimely death. So the economic impact of all those people who don't die is $1 billion a year. Mm. And that's a pretty good number. I believe that.
Mm. You mentioned people moving to the coast. How are we building houses in the right way or wrong way when it comes to hurricanes?
Well, some places the building codes are very good. And normally the lifetime of a suburban residence is something like 70 years. After that much time, it's been torn down, the neighborhood's changed. It's not the same building. So it doesn't make sense to build for the 500-year event or to spend a lot of money to prepare for it. On the other hand, you don't want a house which, if the sort of thing that you could reasonably expect over the lifetime of the structure happens, is going to kill the people living in it.
Yeah. Well, are there things that we could do better without spending a lot of money? I know your colleagues have been looking at things like, roofing nails.
Yeah. I mean, some of this stuff is really prosaic. Turns out that there's a kind of nail that you can buy at your local lumber yard that's called a ring shank nail. And if you use those to nail down your roof, as my colleague Ricardo Alvarez has shown, it takes three times as much pressure difference to pull the roof sheathing off. Hmm. And the contractors love these things, because they're actually a little bit cheaper to install. So it's a win-win-win situation for the homeowner and the contractor and the insurer. That's the sort of thing we're really hoping for. It isn't always that simple.
Well, Professor, thank you very much.
Okay, my pleasure.
Professor Hugh Willoughby is at the International Hurricane Research Center at Florida International University in Miami.
Hurricane-force winds of controversy have already been blowing now for weeks on Wall Street. Last night, they finally blew apart the career of Richard Grasso, the chairman and chief executive of the New York Stock Exchange. Grasso offered his resignation because of the storm over his $140 million retirement package. 13 of 20 stock exchange directors accepted the offer. Well, joining us now to discuss the rise and fall of Richard Grasso and what it may mean for the stock exchange is Gretchen Morgenson of the New York Times. Welcome, Gretchen.
How are you?
Good, Gretchen. Thanks for joining us. Gretchen, what brought down Richard Grasso? Was it, in the end, the sheer kind of tackiness of the huge payout he was about to receive, $140 million in deferred pay and retirement benefits in tough economic times?
Could it be something as simple as greed?
Yeah.
And hubris.
Yeah, maybe.
It seems like it's the same old story, doesn't it? It never ceases to amaze me how these people just don't understand how bad these things look. First, it was the pay package, and it was the way that the pay package came out in dribs and drabs. I mean, if something is going to come out like this, as explosive as this, you want to get it out there all at once. You don't want it to sort of seem like it's coming in little pieces. Then there was the fact that the board didn't, quote, understand, end quote, how much they had given him, which was completely baffling to anybody with a brain.
And then it turns out that he actually had the power to appoint the board that decided on his salary.
And furthermore, that the board consists of people he is supposed to be policing.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of problems, and it sort of swamped him, overtook him, the events overtook him, and finally he got the picture.
So how's it going to change the stock exchange, Gretchen, if at all?
I think the changes could be very, very vast. First of all, people understand that this is something that should not be run by one person who oversees both the regulatory aspect and the trading floor. That is a basic conflict of interest that just cannot be avoided, and it has to be split up, as it has done on the NASDAQ stock market. That is a huge change. I mean, I think people are even going to question the idea of whether the exchange can police itself. Another huge change. And the fact of the matter is Mr. Grasso was very good at staving off competition and keeping the status quo on the floor, and I think having him gone is going to probably mean that those changes that have been called for years will be more likely to occur.
Mm. There is an element of poignancy somewhere in this story, right? I mean, here's the son of a single mother brought up in Queens, starts out as a clerk. Is it being felt on Wall Street at all as kind of a sad or poignant story?
Well, I'm sure there are a lot of people who appreciate what he did, and he did have his good points and was a very strong proponent of the exchange, especially during challenging times, and no one is going to take that away from him. But a person who is a quasi-government figure, i.e. who has the public interest at heart, has to understand that his behavior has to be beyond reproach. Like Caesar's wife, he has to be, you know, completely clean. And Mr. Grasso just never quite understood that. And so to the degree that conspired against him, it's reasonable that he should walk the plank.
Yeah. Things were supposed to change in the big-time business world after Enron and all these other scandals. Now one more. Are we going to see more?
Are we going to see more scandals?
Yeah.
I think so. Unfortunately, these things take a long time to iron out. And as Mr. Grasso didn't get it, quote unquote, how bad it looked that he made all that money and how bad it looked that the board that he oversaw was, in fact, made up of people he policed, other CEOs still don't get it. Now, we are seeing some that do get it and that are changing their ways. But unfortunately, I think the kind of sweeping change that we need is slow in coming.
Gretchen Morgenson, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, anytime.
Gretchen Morgenson covers the corporate world for the New York Times.
Just ahead, an architect in Beirut incorporates the city's violent past in the blueprint for new buildings.
And later in the show, it's Apple versus Apple. The music company takes the computer maker to court.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
It used to be called the Paris of the Mediterranean. Lebanon's capital, Beirut, was said to be everything a city built between the mountains and a beautiful sea should be. Cosmopolitan, glamorous, historic. Then came the 15-year civil war, and when the war ended in 1990, the rebuilding. Billions have been spent. And rising from the rubble of the buildings of Beirut are, in some cases, the rubble of the buildings of Beirut. Ruins of war made new. They're the creations of architect Bernard Khoury. They are disturbing, and they're meant to be. Joining us on the line from Beirut is architect Bernard Khoury. Welcome.
Thank you.
By the way, we should mention for our listeners, you can go to our website, here-now.org, and you can see the pictures that we're talking about and that I'm looking at right now. But in the meantime, let's start with a disco that you built. It's an underground discotheque that mimics a military bunker. It's built on a site where Falangist militias massacred Palestinian refugees in 1976. It's called B-018. What were you thinking?
I would say that this building was more of a kind of a response to the general amnesia that was that came after the war. And it's very typical. After a war, people don't like to remember or refer or go back to their recent past. And the rebuilding of Beirut has been very sterile, I would say. And B-018 is a kind of a reaction to that. I don't think that Beirut was a postcard city. I don't think it should be a postcard city. I think it's a much more complex city than what the reconstruction tries to portray. So B-018 was a sort of a parasite in the middle of that very sweet landscape of reconstruction.
What would you say to someone, maybe someone from Beirut, I don't know if they've said this to you, or someone from elsewhere who would say, it's obscene to place a discotheque or a restaurant on a place where people died?
Well, then it would be obscene to live anywhere or to enjoy life anywhere in Beirut, because Beirut has been a battlefield. In every single street corner, there is something that has happened. Somebody died or somebody was killed at some point during that civil war. Or let's say the city center, at least, which has been totally rebuilt and packed with restaurants and bars and Gucci stores and that kind of thing. Life has to go on, and it is normal that you go back to these sites and you inject life into them. I think it would be less respectful to put buildings that negate the recent history.
You've said that you want to be able to feel some of this that's already happened in your life. You don't want to paper it over. What are you saying about the city of Beirut and the people there?
I think Beirut, and I've said it, and I keep on saying it through my buildings, is a very, very, is a hyper-contemporary city. You find in Beirut many of the aspects and many of the absurdities you may find in New York or in very Western cities. But Beirut takes these issues and exaggerates them. Because we live here in a totally capitalistic environment, In fact, that this part of the world is embracing capitalism sometimes in a scary way, and this is what happens. You get urban and social absurdities, and you feel them in the city, and you see them. And I think it's going to be the case with Baghdad tomorrow, and I think it's the case with New York too. I mean, it is these complexities that make a city interesting.
Well, I think the buildings are intriguing, but I'm wondering if this is your intent to sort of underline for people of Beirut your feelings about maybe capitalistic pursuits, hedonism. You know, if they're having a great time at these buildings, have you been successful?
I'm not pointing out at capitalism or at the people who are clubbing or enjoying their sushi meals at $50 or $60 a pop and saying to them that they're bad. In fact, I'm part of them. I mean, I go to these places. I can party there or enjoy my meal at the Japanese restaurant or at the Central restaurant, and I think there's nothing wrong with that. I don't have this moralistic attitude mm-hmm. that says this is right and this is wrong. I just say that this is Beirut. This is our history. Let's celebrate it, but let's at least be conscious of it.
Mm. Come to the cabaret, but eyes wide open. Some of the elements of your buildings, in one, bouncers dressed up like soldiers. In another, a sniper's window preserved in one building. Tables that fold over and look like coffins when they are folded over. Would you ever propose buildings like this, let's say, at Ground Zero in New York?
I think Ground Zero is a very complex issue. For Ground Zero, we have a sort of a trauma because it was something that was very foreign to the Americans. It was the first time for a long, long time that you have foreign, let's say, terrorism attacking U.S. interests in the middle of the U.S. So it's a much more dramatic issue because it's an accident in some ways. It's got nothing to do with New York as we know New York.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, you have to understand that we don't have memorials in Lebanon because we did not agree on a history. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., it's completely different. Things are very clear for you. You know what's good and you know what's bad, or at least you're taught what's good and what's bad. And you know that what has happened at Ground Zero was a catastrophe and it was bad. Point. Period. So if you have to raise a memorial there, it's clear. For us, it's completely different. We don't talk about war. Mm. So our only way to address political issues in architecture is to do it through entertainment projects. So it's a very, very different world. I have a hard time trying to, you know, compare both.
Mm. Well,
because I did not intend to make a memorial
right.
in Beirut. I was not asked to do one.
Well, Bernard Corey, thank you so much. It's just one of the most interesting, thought-provoking things I've seen in a long time.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Beirut architect Bernard Khoury. For pictures of his creations, go to our website, here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a European summit to decide how much to put in the U.S. tin cup for Iraq. We'll have a preview.
And are you destroying the music you've illegally downloaded on your computer? And if you are, should you?
That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, what's in a name? A big money lawsuit, that's what, as Apple Music sues Apple Computers.
And the Dalai Lama says violence might be necessary to fight terrorism. Or does he?
And Natalie McMaster, one of Cape Breton's best fiddlers, teams up with a group of Newgrass music greats like Daryl Anger.
We were talking about players, and he said, well, let's start at the top. So we were saying, let's try and get Bela and Jerry and, you know, Edgar Meyer. And I'm like, what? Do you think we can get those guys? And what ended up happening is every musician we wanted on this record said yes.
Cape Breton meets Appalachia, coming up Here and Now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. Hurricane Isabel is starting to lash North Carolina's outer banks, bringing howling winds and stinging rains and churning up a pounding surf. The Category 2 storm is packing maximum winds of up to 100 miles an hour. More from reporter Lisa Goddard in Nag's Head.
I got to tell you, the wind is affecting pretty much everything in sight right now. All the beach grasses and the trees are bowing down low to the ground, but cars are still able to move out here. The few that are moving around are mostly emergency officials. They're checking for downed power lines, and I think I just saw a rescue official move what looks like a phone line out of the middle of the road.
That is reporter Lisa Goddard in Nag's Head, North Carolina. Isabel has already knocked out power to tens of thousands of customers. The nation's capital is buttoned up in preparation for Hurricane Isabel. Lawmakers have departed, and most of the everyday people were told to stay home. President Bush has even left for Camp David a day early. President says the nation is ready to weather the storm.
We've got pre-positioned equipment in place. Proper warnings have gone out, and the communication systems are up and running so that when the storm hits, the response for the citizens will be an effective response.
Schools are closed today in expectation of wind gusts upward of 70 miles per hour and heavy rains. Isabel is expected to hit full force sometime today. President Bush says Yasser Arafat has failed as Palestinian leader. Following a meeting at Camp David with Jordan's King Abdullah today, Bush told reporters that Arafat is to blame for the resignation of Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas, who was committed to the peace process. Bush says that if Palestinians want peace, they must have a new leader. In Iraq, guerrillas ambushed a U.S. military convoy, setting off a gun battle that wounded a three-year-old boy in the town of Qaldiya, west of Baghdad. The U.S. military said two American soldiers were wounded, but it was not clear if that was the result of that ambush or a later attack. Nearby in Fallujah, witnesses say a 14-year-old boy was killed after an American patrol mistook for an attack the celebratory fire of a wedding. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 70 points at 96.16. The NASDAQ composite is ahead 15 at 18.98. You are listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
It's a long way, a long and winding road, in fact, since Apple Music and Apple Computers were founded by brilliant young longhairs weaned on 60s flower power who weren't all that interested in business and money and lawyers. Well, that was then. Now, Apple Music, founded by the Beatles, is suing Apple Computer, named in honor of the Beatles, and it's actually not the first time. Joining us to explain is John Fort, mobile technology reporter who covers Apple for the San Jose Mercury News. Welcome, John.
Thank you. Good to be here.
John, this is not the first time that Apple Music has sued Apple Computers, right?
Well, Apple Music sued Apple Computer the first time not long after Apple Computer was founded. And Apple Music came to an agreement, somewhat amicable, on some of the terms under which they could each use the name. There was another bit of a legal tussle later on when Apple Computer first began to ship computers with CD-ROM drives and speakers. So as the world of technology has edged closer and closer to the world of music and multimedia, the lines have become blurrier and blurrier.
John, as you understand it, what's the lawsuit all about? Why is Apple Music suing Apple Computer?
Well, I think it comes down to the name. Apple Music, its association with music, it wants Apple and its computers to stay on the other side of the fence. I think to us over here on this side of the pond, who might not, and maybe of a later generation, who might not associate the Beatles and Apple that closely, it seems a little strange. But I think as the Beatles and their heirs continue to release later and later albums, they want to protect that trademark and protect that name.
What could the impact of this lawsuit be on the Apple Music service, which has led to the downloading of some 10 million songs, I believe, for 99 cents apiece?
Steve Jobs isn't known to really shrink at a fight, and the entire world of technology is pretty serious about this music stuff. So at this point, the analysts are saying that they're pretty confident that they'll come to some agreement over this, whether this means Apple Computer will have to use its $4 billion free cash hoard and pay a little cash to the remainder of the Beatles and their heirs or what, I'm not sure. But they seem pretty confident that one way or another, they'll work this out.
Now, the Beatles are not downloadable within the Apple Music Store, as it's called, which is the downloadable service within iTunes on Apple computers. Obviously, that has something to do with this?
I'm not sure how much that has to do with this. There are so many of the more prominent artists who have taken a while to show up, the Rolling Stones, for example, because the world of digital music and the world of music are having a hard time working through the particulars about who gets paid for what when it comes to downloaded music.
Do you think that inevitably mega groups like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones are going to have to get with one of these downloading services because it's the wave of the future?
Well, I think that's what Apple's counting on. And we're starting to see some Rolling Stones showing up in the iTunes music store for Apple. That as it becomes clear that this is the way that consumers want their music, and as it becomes clear that this is a viable way for it to happen, that it's not another way for piracy to go on, but it's a viable means of business, that folks are going to say, hey, well, let's figure out a way to make this work.
John, what's the future of downloadable music? People being sued for downloading from services like Kazaa and others illegally, but inevitably will people be more and more and more buying their music off computers?
Absolutely. We see these services cropping up from different companies. We see Apple in this fall-winter time frame planning to roll its iTunes music store out to more than just Apple users, but to Windows users as well. But I'll tell you what, I think that the music piracy is going to continue. There's a certain group of people out there who just think it's fun to illicitly swap tunes, and there's another group of people out there that's always working on software and ways over the internet to hide people's identities and allow folks to be able to get their sharing done without the notice of the big record companies.
John Fort, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
John Fort writes about Apple computers for the San Jose Mercury News.
On the first anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks, the Dalai Lama, a Nobel Peace Prize winner, said it is appropriate to respond to an act of violence by employing the principles of nonviolence. But a few days ago, he told an audience in Boston the Second World War and the Korean War made positive contributions to society, and time will tell if the Iraq War does the same thing. He repeated that in an interview printed today in the New York Times and added, "Terrorism is the worst kind of violence, so we have to check it. We have to take countermeasures." Well, is the Dalai Lama proposing violence? We called Jhumpa Kunshat Prior of the Tibetan Cultural Society in Malden, Massachusetts, who found that notion unthinkable.
Within the vows of a monk, you're not allowed to kill. If you think back of the history of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, that 1.2 million Tibetans have been killed by the Chinese, and still he's a proponent of peace and understanding in dialect, then you understand the contents of the quotation or the statement that he made. The countermeasures is necessary. Of course there's countermeasures, but countermeasures don't necessarily mean that violence. It doesn't imply violence.
You would expect the Dalai Lama to say that no war is good.
I think that he said that in his statement, that the real antidote to terrorism is in the long run, compassion, dialogue, peaceful means, even with terrorists. People do have the right in order to protect themselves. Everyone has the right to protect themselves. The level of protection, or the level that we go to, is governed by our beliefs. Now, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, being a monk, a fully ordained monk, knows that being a monk, you cannot condone the idea of killing anyone. Therefore, in his quote, "The real antidote to terrorism is compassion," definitely falls 100% behind what His Holiness has been saying since the loss of Tibet up until now.
Jhumpa Kunshat Prior of the Tibetan Cultural Society on the Dalai Lama's comments in today's New York Times, seeming to say that terrorism calls for a violent response. To Here and Now.
It's Thursday when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Our segment on the unreliability of old voting machines and the lack of security on some new voting machines drew this response from Robert Cooper of Wellesley, Massachusetts. Yes, he says, punched card and lever machines are unreliable and being phased out, and yes, touchscreen voting machines from a major manufacturer have deeply flawed reliability and security. But optical scanning machines are a good option right now. Although there are some concerns about the software in these machines as well, the existence of a paper ballot as a permanent, non-electronic record of the voter's intent makes these machines the best choice.
Our conversation with Rice University political scientist Earl Black about the presidential candidacy of General Wesley Clark prompted Martha Schwope of Concord, Mass. To call.
Excellent question about what's he going to be in economics. The guy said, "I don't know. Nobody knows him. Who knows him? Doesn't really know much." You know, he taught economics at West Point. The guy knows economics. He's been in business. He's been a CEO. He's been on boards of directors. He's a well-rounded candidate.
Our story on the Newfoundlanders who took in stranded travelers on 9/11 2 years ago drew this thank you from Stephen Raymond of Lexington, Massachusetts. He writes, "I find myself unable to cry for the people who perished, perhaps because of the magnitude of the horror or the surreal sight of skyscrapers collapsing. But when I hear stories like the one you told today, my eyes instantly fill up with tears. It's the beauty of human experiences like these that are taken for granted and need to be appreciated in the daily lives of each of us."
Well, health columnist Judy Foreman's report on restless legs syndrome, or RLS, drew a lot of response. Ray Beckler of South Coventry Township, Pennsylvania, writes, "I've been experiencing symptoms for the past 5 years, and in my case, it was related to an iron deficiency. I had ignored the symptoms, passing them off as just something strange. In my case, the iron deficiency was caused by a slow leak, bleeding from undetected colon cancer. I'm happy to report that the cancer is gone, and thanks to iron supplements, the symptoms have been relieved. Restless leg syndrome can be an indication of something far more serious.
But Brendy Mendelson writes, your health editor recommended iron or other medicines to help restless leg syndrome. I've found activity in the day is the best cure. The quickest fix for many health problems is to get up and move around as our bodies were intended to be used.
Well, finally, we received several thank yous for our segment on healthier school lunch alternatives. But Elaine Olligood of Belmont, Massachusetts, had this comment.
I was really hoping for something better than peanut butter because in my kids' school, you can't send your kid to school with a peanut butter and jelly sandwich because of the kids who have fatal tree nut allergies and peanut allergies. It's just not in the cards. And I dare say most elementary schools have that. So could you go back and do it again and skip the peanut butter and find me a lunch my kid will eat? Thanks.
Well, if anyone has any suggestions, send them, along with any of your thoughts on our program. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your name, phone number, and the town where you live.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Since she was just a wee one, 30-year-old Scottish-Canadian Natalie McMaster has carried on Cape Breton's 250-year-old tradition of fiddling with amazing grace and skill. Vibrant, freewheeling, steeped in its Scottish roots, maybe one reason Cape Breton fiddling's endured is how isolated the place is. A small, exquisite region of Nova Scotia where fiddle music pours from pubs, kitchens, and house parties. And it courses head to toe through Natalie McMaster, right down to her uncannily agile fingertips. In the past, she's blended conventional fiddle styles, playing with artists as diverse as Carlos Santana, The Chieftains, Paul Simon, and Luciano Pavarotti. With her new CD, McMaster forges a new musical bridge spanning Cape Breton and Appalachia. Blueprint was recorded in Nashville, produced by Newgrass great Daryl Anger, and features cameo performances by some of contemporary bluegrass music's biggest stars, including Sam Bush on mandolin and Bella Fleck on banjo. Natalie McMaster is in the studio now to tell us more about her new recording, Blueprint. And thanks for coming in, Natalie.
Thank you for having me.
Your influences vary as widely as your mother, father, and especially your uncle, Buddy McMaster, who's a renowned Cape Breton fiddler himself and who taught you to play, right? To Michael Jackson, AC/DC, and Def Leppard records.
Right.
Well, I should tell you, I guess Buddy taught me to play unbeknownst to him.
Huh.
His music was a huge influence on me, and I've listened to more Buddy music than any other one fiddler, and he has definitely had the biggest influence. My official teacher was Stan Chapman. But with regards to the other influences there, that's my brothers. I've got two older brothers, and they used to listen to Ozzy Osbourne and every kind of heavy thing you can imagine. And, you know, it's like anything. If you hear something enough, you're going to learn to like it.
Ozzy penetrates everywhere, even Cape Breton Island. Huh?
Yep, that's right.
Apparently you do like to make fiddle music new, contemporary, like the piece Minnie and Alex's Reel with Victor Wooten's bass providing a contemporary backdrop to the fiddling on this cut.
Well, Victor Wooten is just spectacular, and anyone who knows that name knows what he's capable of. He will knock your socks off. He's very much a virtuoso player, but in this particular track, he's got this natural, relaxed, subtle quality, and there's all these beautiful little things that he's doing within it.
Another cut on the album where you can almost taste the communication between you and the other great musicians on this album is the You with the Crooked Horn, with Sam Bush on the mandolin and Bella Fleck on the banjo.
That's right. The You with the Crooked Horn was probably, of all the tracks, the most independent track with regards to the musicians. Like, all the players really had more creative expression, and so it really came to life when they started playing it. I mean, this is the first time I've played with these guys, and my music is something that they are not familiar with. It's Cape Breton-style fiddling, and it was just boom. I play my thing, they play their thing, and it just clicked.
Drew you to their thing? Newgrass, the Newgrass movement, people like Daryl Anger?
What drew me to these musicians is their musicality. And when I get into a certain type of music, it's not because of the style, it's because of the player.
Like recording in Nashville?
Loved it. When Daryl agreed to produce this record for me, we were talking about players, and he said, well, let's start at the top. Let's try and get Bela and Jerry and, you know, Edgar Meyer. And I'm like, what? Do you think we can get those guys? And he would call me every couple of days and say, I spoke to so-and-so, and they'd love to do it. And what ended up happening is every musician we wanted on this record said yes. So most of them were in the Nashville area, so it just made total sense for me to come to them.
Most of the tracks on this CD are instrumentals. Many are composed either by you, Daryl Anger, or Bella Fleck. But the last song, My Love, Cape Breton and Me, was written by your cousin, Bob Quinn, and sung by his 18-year-old daughter at your wedding last October. You're smiling. Mm-hmm. It's about longing for Cape Breton. But you moved to Ontario after the wedding, didn't you? Do you miss Cape Breton?
I haven't had a chance to miss Cape Breton yet. I've been home more now than my mother's making sure I visit a lot. Oh. Yeah, we finished the project, as I mentioned, in May, and I got married in October. So I was just freshly married, and I'm sitting beside my new husband, and the first thing I hear after we exchange vows is this beautiful song that I've heard before but had never affected me in this way. And just the fact that I'm sitting beside my husband, the love of my life, I'm, you know, a Cape Breton girl and always have been, and now I'm moving away. I'm going to Ontario. And I was sitting there thinking, oh my gosh, I have to protect this moment, save it. Let's record it. So that's what I did.
Sing me a song of your hills, of mountains and waters so still. A song that will speak of the magic of three, my love, Cape Breton and me.
You can take the woman out of Cape Breton, but you can't take the Cape Breton out of the woman.
That's for sure. I like it like that.
No matter how far flung your travels and your great fiddling will take you. Yeah. Well, thanks a lot for coming in.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Cape Breton fiddler Natalie McMaster. Her new album is called Blueprint. For more information on her music and her current tour, visit our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
Arnold is appearing on Oprah, Larry King, Howard Stern. Whatever happened to equal time?
And we'll preview the weekend's European summit. How much will be put in the U.S. tin cup for rebuilding Iraq?
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.